You're listening to WKXL in the morning at 1450 AM, 103.9 FM Concord, 101.9 FM Manchester, and nhtalkradio.com. I'm your host, AJ Kirsted. Let's get the latest New Hampshire government news with our friends at the New Hampshire Bulletin. Get their articles at newhampshirebulletin.com. To join WKXL in the morning every Friday. I'm joined this week by reporter Ethan DeWitt. Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So, Ethan, you got an article that's going to be coming out today on some updates to the education credits or whatever the heck is going on with that.
Sure. So, basically, this is a bill that got approved. It's rare for bills, anything interesting to happen to bills this late in the year, but this got approved or recommended by the House Education Committee. And it's not law yet. It still has a long way to go, but it would expand upon a program that the Republican House and Senate and governor passed this year called the Education Freedom Account Program. This is the program that allows parents to take the state portion of funding for their local public school and take it with their child to private school or to homeschooling tuition. And so this was passed this year. There were many attempts to do it this year, but this latest bill that might be moving forward next year would apply that same, they're not vouchers, but they're sort of similar to vouchers. They're basically savings accounts that allow you to use the money towards a bunch of educational expenses. It would apply that towards local tax money as well. So when you have a student in a public school system, a large amount of that money is coming from local taxpayers, local property taxpayers, and then a smaller amount is coming from the state. So the program that exists now uses that smaller amount, which averages about $4,600 per student. The larger amount that covers the rest of it is coming out of local townspeople. Your property taxes are going towards that. And so this second bill would allow for towns to opt in and school districts to opt into a system that would allow their residents to use that tuition money that would be going towards the public school and use it instead towards private school or homeschooling or other educational expenses. So,
I'd imagine a lot of municipalities would be quite unhappy about the possibility of losing funding, especially considering a lot of them are struggling as it is with low numbers in some towns, as well as just the amount of money they managed to pull in from taxes.
Yeah, so I should say, I mean, this is obviously was controversial. This legislation is going to be controversial. The EFA bill, Education Freedom Account bill that passed this year was controversial. Republicans and school choice advocates like it because it basically gives parents the decision over how to use the public money that usually goes towards their school district. But obviously public school advocates and Democrats don't like it because they say that there are, you know, legitimate concerns that this could divert money away from towns and from schools and also raise local property taxes. So this is sort of the next iteration of that. One interesting thing about this is, as I said, it's an opt-in. It's what they call enabling legislation, which means that if this bill, which again just has just cleared a committee, it hasn't gone anywhere yet, still needs to go get a vote on the House floor in January, but this bill, if it were made into law, it wouldn't apply across the state. The towns and the districts would have to vote for it in order to opt into it. So you wouldn't automatically have, you know, the ability for parents in your school district to take their money that comes from your local tax dollars. You would have to have voted for that. And the threshold that is set out in the bill is actually quite high. It's 60%. So at the annual school meeting, which, you know, those can get contentious over all kinds of reasons, that typically happen in spring, this would be a valid warrant article. That's what the bill is allowing. So you could bring forward a warrant article. You would need a 60% of the voters to vote for it. And then you would have this system and only then. So that its defenders are saying this is only really for the towns where there's overwhelming support for this kind of school choice program.
Which from a political perspective, a majority of the larger cities where a lot more of the Democrats in the state are located, they're not going to vote for this, especially at the 60% threshold. So it seems like a bit of an interesting concept that the Republicans are putting forward and the activist left are just like, no, this is a bad idea just on principle.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say that, because when Republicans talk about this, and there was quite a lot of heated discussion this week in the committee about it, there's two arguments that they make that seem a little contradictory, but basically they're pointing to two attitudes. One is that everyone still likes their local public schools by and large, and they say this is not an attack on public schools. But they also say at the same time, the school choice movement is growing, and as we've seen across the country, there is an appetite for kind of more choice in schools, and there's also dissatisfaction by a faction of the country and the state with public schools. And so they're arguing that this would not decimate public schools because people still are going to, by and large, want their children to attend their local public school and want to support them. But it's an option for parents that do. But to your point about kind of which towns would vote for this, one Republican on the House Education Committee, Ralph Boehm, said, I'll read you the quote, he said 60% would have to vote for it. I don't know any town that would. If they did, they'd have a really bad public school system. So some of the representatives who support this, they still support it, but they're saying that this is really kind of like a measure for towns that really feel strongly about this, and you'd have to have a pretty dire situation. Others say this is an opportunity, a positive opportunity for an option that parents can take. But everyone is stressing on the Republican side that this is an opt-in system that wouldn't be alive.
Yeah, I mean, that makes it, it should in theory meet the middle ground for what people would want. I mean, because you need to have that vote going on in each town, it's like Concord School District, I mean, with some of the things that have happened over the last 4 years or so with regards to the superintendent and the high school especially, if this was around back then, this could have really lit a fire into the school district to fix things up.
Yeah, I think it's definitely going to be, if it passes, we have to see. The sponsor himself says he's not sure, you know, where it's going to go. He's focusing on getting votes in the House before he can speak about the Senate, and then you have the governor. So we don't know where it's going to go. If it does, though, I think it does raise a lot of interesting political questions, because you're talking about a measure that feasibly could become costly for a district if there were a lot of take up, for instance, but also could provide a lot of opportunities in the way that school choice advocates want. So when you have these annual meetings, you know, taxes are the number one thing on most people's mind, but there's also a rising, amount of support that we've seen, again, as I said, across the country for these kinds of programs. So I would be very curious to see how this would play out in an actual meeting, because there's one aspect to it that I didn't mention, which is that students that take advantage, if this were to pass, and a town were to implement this program, students and their families could take advantage of the program, and that would probably be anywhere between $5,000 to $20,000 a year, because every district spends different. And you also have to take into account a lot of other costs. So you're looking at potentially maybe $8,000, $9,000, $10,000, depends where you live. If you're living in a district that spends a lot, you could be up to the $15,000 per year. And the way this law works, there's a grandfathering system. So whatever the allocation is in the year that you enter the program is the allocation that is guaranteed to you, your family, and to your child for the entirety of their K-12 education. So that would carry all the way until 12th grade. Even if the town later votes to rescind the program, the kids who were signed up for it would be guaranteed to keep receiving these funds. Oh. So when you're looking at the expenses, that could be a difficult pill to swallow for some. You know, it's hard to turn back if you already have kids in there. But its supporters note that the reason they're doing that is because it would be unfair to provide a service to a family that they might start to rely on. They might send their kid to a new school and then have to yank them out of that because the program ended. So there's two sides there, but you can see how financially it can get a little bit tricky. And I think it'd be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, definitely. A big question to me when it comes to school funding and in New Hampshire, I'm assuming it's the same in all states, is the if these school districts, and I'm shocked I don't see more of this coming from the Democrats that push for education reform, is just to have the state fund all of the education for all the towns centrally, just because of this confusion, because each school district collects different amounts of money. This is going to really show what that difference is as different local taxpayers begin to actually investigate what's going on with their money. I mean, like me, I'm a renter. Like, I don't directly pay that. My poor landlord's got to pay that bill, but there's a lot of questions that maybe this will start opening people's eyes to consider how education funding is done, period.
Yeah, and that is interesting. And that was actually brought up a lot by Democrats who are opposing it. They're pointing to, if you live in a rich town, this is another divide. Mm-hmm. If you live in a rich town, and there's another thing I should mention is there's no income cap on this program. The statewide program that exists now has an income cap of 300,000 300% of the federal poverty line, which is about $80,000 for a family of four. So if you're a family of four, you make over $80,000, you don't qualify. With this proposed program, which would be the local program, the opt-in program for towns, there is no income limit. So as soon as the town opts in, however much money the families have, they could use it. So if you had a lot of money and were sending your kid to a private school already, that's an example of an area where it could get expensive.
And I'm guessing the towns can't put a bunch of provisions on top of it.
No, again, this is the earliest stage of this process. I should say that if this bill moves ahead, and again, we'll see how it works out on the House floor and how the Senate takes it. There might be a lot of changes, and Governor Sununu has not waited on it at all. But it does fit with a larger effort that Republicans are making that we've seen over the past few years. And it really comes down to a different way of looking at public education funding. When I talked to the sponsor, Representative Kevin Verville, he said that when he hears the term public education, he sees it as providing public money to educate children, period. He doesn't see it as providing public money to educate children in a public school. Of course, that's been how it's been looked at for decades, and that's certainly how Democrats would see it and how public school advocates would see it. And they say that's what public education is. It's your neighborhood school. Republicans, as we've seen in recent years, have really kind of leaned into the idea that it should just be public money going towards education. That could be private, that could be homeschool, that could be online. There's other avenues other than just public school. And that's the divide, those two visions. And with every new bill like this that comes through, the two parties are even further apart. Like, I don't really see how, with this moving ahead, how the parties could ever really come together on education anytime soon.
Yeah. All right. We got about 7 minutes left. I want to touch on another article you had. Uproar over reform to report teachers to the state's Commission for Human Rights is getting a lot of attention. What's your article going on with that?
Yeah. So last week first of all, there's a law that you may have heard of. It was originally called the Divisive Concepts Law. It's no longer called that anymore. It is an anti-discrimination law that was put into the budget that essentially regulates the certain teaching in public schools and also in public bodies in the state, and regulates how teachers and employees talk about race and gender and systematic oppression. That basically prevents them from a number of things, teaching that one race or gender or class is superior to another, or that it kind of dissuades them from teaching about that structural racism or structural sexism is a reality. They can talk about race and gender, but they can't kind of go into the territory of arguing that there is some sort of systemic oppression. So this was a really kind of controversial law when it came out. A lot of public school advocates say that this is going to have a chilling effect in the classroom. But what has happened last week is the Department of Education released a web form that allows you as a parent to submit a complaint if you believe that your teacher in your child's school is violating this. And when you send in that complaint, it goes to the New Hampshire Commission for Human Rights. This is what my article was about. This agency has for decades been investigating alleged human rights violations and alleged breaches of the state's anti-discrimination laws. So this could be, you know, you were fired because of your gender or your sexual orientation or your race. And so they've been doing this for a while. But with this new form and with all of the national energy that's kind of surrounding, you know, critical race theory around school teachings that we've seen, there, this little agency that not many people talk about is suddenly now in the spotlight because parents can now send forms directly to it. So I kind of took a look at what this means for the woman who runs the agency and what they're going to do if they get a deluge of parents.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to get a ton of attention here. As soon as that first case ends up coming, like if they ever get in a situation where it's, they do find it, something that goes against this quote divisive concepts law unquote, and the it's going to be headlines all over the, it could be all over the country with it, because not many states actually managed to get something like this to go through.
Yeah, and it also has professional it has ramifications professionally for teachers. There is a provision in the law that says that if a teacher, if an educator violates it, then they can come before the state board of education and they can have a discipline. That doesn't necessarily mean that their license is revoked, but it does include the possibility their license is revoked. And so that's part of why the attention is on this commission. I talked to the director, Ani Malachi, and she says that basically the commission is going to evaluate these claims neutrally, and the way that it does for any claim, there's an intake process. So if your claim doesn't stand, I mean, if your claim is completely out of bounds from what the law even addresses, then it will be dismissed right away. If it is in bounds, there'll be a conversation. They may open an investigation. They have commissioners who do that. And so it was interesting, but is it the way that she described it was that they were going to be, again, neutral arbiters here, but you're talking about an issue that has been, you know, has inspired a lot of conversation, debate, very angry school board meetings. And so it's kind of what we're seeing a collision coming up between this sober institution and kind of the politics.
Yeah, looking at the law, like it outlines so much that it's very hard to really narrow down exactly where that line is between diving too deep into CRT and like what level of the whole, like Ibram X. Kendi anti-racism stuff, like what are their kids books okay, which are you can have your own opinions on one way or another, versus like the full on you're reading how to be an anti-racist book, like that being in the library too far, like it's not clear. There weren't any anecdotes in the law to say this is the line.
Yeah. And I should note that the Attorney General has weighed in with a frequently asked question sheet that does say that it is totally fine to talk about race and gender and all of these topics as they relate to history. It's totally okay to talk about oppression in the past and even to talk about like allegations of oppression. You just can't kind of teach things as fact in any one direction. I did talk to a teacher about how she is handling this new law. She's a ninth grade English teacher. And she's been teaching for 10 years. And, you know, a standard novel that you read in high school is To Kill a Mockingbird. She is out of caution because she's not sure how this commission will start to rule. And she's not sure how this law will be interpreted. She's changing the way she teaches that book a little bit. Generally, when she talks about it, there are obviously, you know, Harper Lee intended it to be a examination of, you know, Southern society and the American legal system. So that lends itself to conversations about potential structural racism or how, you know, racism as an idea can be more than just somebody, you know, saying a slur. It can be also something in a system that might, you know, oppress or discriminate. She is now kind of pulling back her definition of racism in reaction to this law and trying to keep it simpler and just sort of talking about the content of the book without veering too much into that area. And she says that it's, you know, something that she is doing partly out of fear of the law. you can take your own conclusions over whether you think that's a good thing that she would be doing that or not. But it is certainly an example of the law actively changing how teachers are teaching classic texts.
Ethan DeWitt, reporter at the New Hampshire Bulletin. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Check out all their articles at NewHampshireBulletin.com. You're listening to WKXL in the Morning.